of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, Rhys DeMille of Republic Services joins us in the first part of the show. And yes, for the 1,000th time, we're going to remind you to not put your grocery store plastic bags or newspaper bags or dry cleaner bags into the recycling can.
But today, Rhys also brought along a special guest to help explain exactly why you shouldn't do that. He's Larry Gibbons, the Director of Business Development with Rocky Mountain Recycling down in Salt Lake City. That's where Republic Services delivers the recyclables that you place in your can each week.
Larry will explain both how the system works and how it fails to work when you chuck non-recyclables like coffee grounds, oil filters, and leftovers in your recycling bin. Rhys and Larry join us in the first part of the show.
Then in the second half, it's the first day of spring, so why not discuss one of our favorite subjects, Chris?
Bees!
honeybees have just spent the past 4 months shivering, literally, in their hives to stay warm, and now they're really hungry.
Really, really hungry.
So what's the state of honeybees and native bees, and, you know, how they're doing these days?
Yeah. Dr. Diana Cox Foster is an entomologist and bee researcher with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She joins us to explain why honeybees, bumblebees, and other ground-based bees are doing, or why they're so important to our health and welfare, and what some of us are doing, like Dr. Foster, to better understand what threatens bee health and populations.
It all comes back to us, doesn't it, Chris?
All us. But you know what? Let's think. Interesting. I think bees are actually more important than we are.
You're probably right.
Or at least those in Washington. Okay.
Remember, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Spend an evening with Portland's favorite little orchestra as they join the Utah Symphony in Abravanel Hall to perform their cosmopolitan blend of vintage pop, jazz, classical, and global styles. Pink Martini with the Utah Symphony, March 21st at Abravanel Hall. Visit utahsymphony.org. Utah Symphony Utah Opera is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on the environment and our relationships with it and impacts upon it, et cetera, et cetera. I'm Chris Cherniak.
Everything about it.
That's right.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us in the studio, the first part of the show, is Rhys DeMille. He's with Republic Services, and also Larry Gibbons, who is with Rocky Mountain Recycling down in Salt Lake City. Now, Larry's here to talk about the material resources facility, material recovery facility,
MRF.
The MRF. I always just say the MRF, the MRF. And we're going to get to you in a few minutes, because Nell and I have a whole bunch of questions for you. It's a fascinating place. That's where all our recyclables end up, hopefully, to be ultimately recycled, but sometimes they're not for reasons. And we'll get to you in a little bit, Larry, but let's chat with you, Rhys, first. You're always here. You come
good
in
to be here. Thank you
every few months to give us an update on how things are going in the world of solid waste and recyclables, particularly here in Summit County. So, and of course, you help sponsor the show, and we always appreciate that too. So, real quick, how was waste management this past winter here in Summit County? What were some of the challenges you had? In a word or two.
Well, in a word or two, a perfect storm.
Okay.
I use that term lightly, but it was tough. And we certainly appreciate the residents in the county who helped us with the struggles that we had. You know, one of the things that we struggle with, obviously, is when the snow comes and the roads are cleared and the snow's moved, you know, to the sides of the road, then that causes issues with where cans are placed and where cars can be parked. And that then that obviously compounds the issue of where our trucks can go. And, you know, oftentimes it also mixes up our normal collection schedule. So where we would typically pick up one area at 8 o'clock in the morning, starting at 7 o'clock in the morning, that road might not be plowed at that time. And, you know, the county and the cities do a great job getting the roads plowed, but sometimes we have to wait for those to be plowed, and that might be a different schedule. They're on a different schedule than we are. And so when a road isn't plowed, we have to go to some different area. And so we're collecting that, which we usually collected at 2 p.m. We're collecting that at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
And people don't have their cans out, and so it just compounds the issue. And so it's been a tough winter.
Right. And tougher than normal. I mean, you face these things every winter to some degree. Accessibility at the end of the day. But this winter, with all the snow, it was extra difficult to do that. And so you were probably fielding a lot of phone calls from concerned clients wondering, where's the truck? Why did it come before I, you know, put my can out, et cetera? But these are it's logistical in nature.
The vast majority is logistical, absolutely. Okay. You know, weather related. We're not going to say that, you know, we don't make mistakes. We pick up nearly 2 million residential customers a year here in the county.
Wow.
And so if you're picking up 2 million cans, there's going to be some misses. I mean, we're human.
Right.
There's going to be some misses. And so, like I said earlier, we certainly appreciate those residents who were able to work with us.
Right.
And, you know, the vast majority, overwhelming majority of people were wonderful and great to work with.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to allow you to a minute or so to explain some of those challenges you had this winter. Now you're all caught up. Thanks to global warming, the snow's gone. And so you don't have that problem anymore.
No, we don't have the snow problem.
Okay, so what is the problem? It's springtime, spring cleaning.
We're seeing a lot more garbage that's being put in the containers. And so with that comes more garbage in the trucks, more trips to the landfill, changes your schedule a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no exact science to this, obviously. And you know, people are cleaning out their garages, and so in come the big items. And so some of that, people try to shove it inside the can or stick it next to the can, and those type of things just cause issues as well.
Okay.
So talk a little bit about how that works. The truck drivers just have to make a judgment when their truck is full, and they have to make a run to the landfill. It's not on a regularly scheduled location. Is that right?
Well, we have what we call route cutoffs, and we would love to be able to go off those route cutoffs. Then we know exactly as soon as this last house is picked up or this last stop, then we can go to the landfill. But that's not always the case. And so they have to judge with the packer mechanism when the truck is full. And, you know, they can't go overweight. Again, you know, that's the law. So as soon as they determine that it's close, then they've got to head to the landfill.
That's a good question, because the other thing I was thinking of is like they'll approach these dumpsters and they'll be full, overflowing, right? And they're jammed with lumber,
couches
and things.
Yeah.
Do they have to make a decision on whether or not they can actually pick up that dumpster, and will that dumpster actually, you know, discharge into the back of the truck, or do they have to get out and
more often
that?
Than not, as the arm grabs the container and lifts it up, anything that's above the container line, so if the lid doesn't shut, there's a risk that that's going to tip out before it gets into the truck. And so, you know, we would love to have everyone be in a place where the lid can shut, and then that's, you know, almost guaranteed that all of that material is going to get into the container.
But if it's sticking
out the top, then there's no guarantee that that's not going to slide out of the can as it's being tipped.
And then who's going to have to pick that up? The driver has to get out and pick all that stuff up that didn't fall into the truck.
Yeah, you know, we hope the driver will do that. That's not what we want them to have to do. That certainly slows them down on their route. But we certainly try to coach and train our drivers to get out and pick that material
okay,
up.
Okay, so the takeaway here is don't overfill these dumpsters to the point where you can't close the lid.
Correct.
The residents.
Ideally, that's correct.
I'm speaking to us, residents.
Correct.
So don't overfill these dumpsters, particularly during this time of spring cleaning, where, like Nell says, there's going to be large objects that people are throwing away.
Correct.
Okay. All right. So that's trash. That's what's going to the landfill. We want to talk about recycling, recyclables. And when you come on, you have your reminder. You're up next in our little sponsorship. They remind people that gray is for garbage, right? And green is for recyclables or so. And what can and can't go into those recyclables? What can't includes glass.
Cannot, correct.
Cannot.
Correct.
Oh, that the problem is here, the challenge is that people who visit here come from other parts of the country where glass is part perhaps of a single stream facility, or people are just used to recycling glass, so they throw their glass into the green bin.
You know, Chris, the best resource for that is to go to summitcountyrecycles.org.
Okay.
And that information is all on there, what can be recyclable, what can be recycled, what can't. And sometimes it's a moving target. You know, certain things that, as we talked, you know, before the show, certain things that were made out of materials that were obviously recyclable at one point in time may not be now. And I'll let Larry talk about this. He's the expert on all this recyclable material. But one thing that we need to make sure that people understand is that just because a product is recyclable doesn't mean it can go in the recycling bin. You know, green waste, certainly recyclable, but it can't go in the recycling bin. Glass, recyclable, but not in the single stream recycling bin.
Okay.
Not in that commingled. And that's kind of like where those plastic bags come in. We've talked a lot about this. The mm-hmm. plastic bags weren't working. Those had to come out of the single stream. That includes the bag that you maybe collected all of your recyclables in.
Right. Larry, so talk about that. I have, I line my recycling bin with a black garbage bag. And I put all my newspapers and plastics in there. And then when they're done, I grab the bag, I zip tie it, and I put it in, and I put it out at the corner to be picked up. That bag ends up at your recycling facility. Are you going to accept that bag?
So the problem with that bag, if we don't know what's in it, that's a whole nother process to get into that bag. And so there are times that those bags, when they're there, they will get thrown out. One of the things that's being done locally and across the United States is bag bans. And that's going to eliminate your grocery sack, but we'll never be able to eliminate, you know, the trash sack that some people put it in.
Mm-hmm.
So our way of addressing that is it adds a significant amount of work. We spend about $30,000 a month in just dealing with the bags. They get wrapped around the shafts. It's one of the number one problems that we have with contamination. The landfills struggle with them. There's probably not another part of this mix that is more inherent of problems along the line. So it is our number one issue to keep the place clean and running
well.
What's
it doing? What are those bags doing?
So what they do, everything that we have runs off of a shaft and a belt.
Okay.
It comes in, it starts with what we call a metering bin, which is about 150 cubic yard tub, and that regulates the flow of recyclables that go up into a line. First area is the pre-sort. The pre-sort is going to identify anything that we don't want to go on, or if we don't know what it is, we have to address it then and there. So to your earlier point, it may come out and go in as a contaminant. We deal with several needle sticks every year. And the problem with that is, you know, you can't stick your hand into a bag that you don't know what's in it. And
right.
So there are times that that'll come out right then and there.
Yeah. So again, the default mechanism is going to be that person that sees that black garbage bag could be full of newspapers, perfectly recycled material. But they don't know what's in it, they're just going to grab it and put it aside, and off to the landfill it goes. So don't put your recyclables inside any plastic bag, black, translucent, clear. It doesn't matter. That's for the health and welfare of your workers.
You're exactly right. If there is a clear bag and we can see that it's recyclables, we'll tear it open, dump
okay.
it out. But if it's dark and we don't know what it is, it's going to go in as a contaminant. Because more times than not, it is just trash that's shown up in there.
Yeah. People just throwing out their trash. Okay. So the process itself, like I say, has a lot of mechanical components to it, maybe centrifuges, magnets, shaker tables. But the first part is actually hand-based, right? People are actually sorting through and pulling out some of the most obvious non-recyclables on a conveyor belt, right?
You're correct. One of the things that's changing our industry a lot is the robotics. But you'll never have a robot that can tell, should I tear open this bag or not? So they'll put a machine in that will tear everything open or tear nothing open. So it's kind of interesting. We're seeing a lot of robotics come into play because of that.
So give us an idea of what that process looks like. This truck comes in the door with a load of recyclables. Walk us through what happens, what
okay.
the process
yeah,
is.
Yeah, perfect. We have a tipping floor that handles about, at any given time we could have, say, 700 ton on this covered tipping floor. So here's this huge pile. We're running 18 hours a day. We're running two shifts. And after your truck comes in, it's dumped into this tipping floor. It's then loaded with a material handler into a metering drum. The metering drum provides a consistent workable flow of the material. Before that, people would just dump a bucket load on and you'd have a huge pile. Then you'd wait for a minute, then another huge pile. So this makes your work consistent. After that comes up, it goes into the pre-sort to where we have 8 employees that look for anything that's a contaminant, anything that could damage the machine as it goes on, the bag issue, all of these different
bowling
things.
Bowling balls.
You name it. We've seen it all. I'm here to tell
vegetative
you.
Vegetative waste.
Correct, yeah.
Pulling out vegetative waste.
We see a lot of yard waste this right. time of year. Mm-hmm. I'll address that in a minute. But
okay.
So it goes from there, and the first part that is addressed is the OCC screen. And basically, that's a system of discs and wheels that are oblong, and they kind of walk, if you will, and they'll grab the cardboard and take it up and out. And so that's the first part that we address. Now, cardboard in Summit County only consists of about 20% of our mix. So we can tell you right down to the specifics what percentage of a commodity is normal. There's other parts in the Wasatch Front based off of the demographics. Let's say South Jordan, a lot of families, bigger homes, they all shop on Amazon. We get probably 30-some-odd% cardboard in a place like South Jordan. So next stop is going to be everything else. So we've pulled out contamination, we've pulled out cardboard. Now we still have our plastic, our paper, our aluminum, and everything else. It goes up another long conveyor, and it goes into any one of 3 fiber screens. And the fiber screens, based off of their pitch and their angle, will capture the material. So if we have almost one that's straight up and down, we'll capture everything in there through another system of discs, and we'll go through those 3 lines. So the first one will grab big chunks of newspaper. The next one will grab junk mail. The next one will grab anything that's about the size of a 6x6 piece of paper and smaller. So those 3 areas go through that. Now, one thing that's kind of neat that we're doing to help the residents and to help our partners like Republic is we've put in an additional optical sorter. And the optical sorter will actually look at the waste and, based off of the reflection of the light, will tell us, is it paper or is it another commodity that's in it? And then with a burst of air, it will separate that out of that mix. So we've gone through now, let's say 70% of our mix that we've picked up at your curb is gone. All your paper, fiber, cardboard, and contamination. So everything else that happens down the line, you mentioned it earlier, we have a belt magnet that pulls all of the metals, the tins, anything that's got a magnetic pull is now taken out. And that's just a very simple belt magnet that grabs that, stores it in a bunker. We have a couple QC areas. We go through, grab those other things, and then another optical sorter to separate number 1 and 2 plastics, all 3 through 7s, and then the last stop is the eddy current to get all of the aluminum.
Wow.
Wow.
There's videos you can watch on YouTube of the process. I love to be able to take a visit of this, but for, like you say, for liability reasons, you don't offer tours. Because you know what? You'd be jammed with tours. You could probably make some money off a tour.
That's another revenue stream right there.
There you go, revenue stream. But we got a few minutes. So you're left with bundles of cardboard, bundles of different types of paper, bundles of plastic, bundles of metal. Where does it go?
Each commodity, and I use that term in a very specific way, it is a commodity.
Right.
We shop that all over the world. Some of it stays local here in the state of Utah. Some of it goes throughout the West. Some of it does go as far away as China. But there's been some political things that have happened that have affected that. We can address that at in a minute. But we do have the recycling markets are very, very healthy. They've gotten really good in the last 6 months. You know, 6-9 months ago, they were terrible. Reese can tell you, as we've had these conversations, it was really bad. But it's gotten good for a number of reasons.
Well, let's follow up on that. We just got a question from a listener. What is the most profitable recyclable? Mm. So let's talk about, you know, what's happened to these prices over the last few months and why.
Okay. The number one most profitable commodity that we deal with is aluminum. And aluminum, once again, in the different demographics, you know, Summit County, there's a little bit more aluminum, beer cans, different things like that. In it ranges about 1 to 1.3% of the total mix in Summit County is aluminum. Now, when we get down into other places, it can drop below 1% of the mix is aluminum. That's the number one most profitable. Aluminum, interestingly enough, is the quickest turn commodity. It can be back in your hands in less than 90 days with a new beverage in it. The majority of our aluminum is sold to Anheuser-Busch. For their aluminum division, it's not all made back into beer, but they do have their aluminum side. And that's the quickest turn commodity and the most profitable commodity that we deal with.
So that stays in the U.S. then?
Absolutely.
The markets here in the U.S. What you say goes to China or Korea might be paper products or other plastics?
3 through 7 mixed plastics typically all go to out of the country. Your 1s and 2s do stay locally. So, you know, when I say locally, within the U.S., but, you know, it's been an interesting, Reese commented earlier about the weather, and that really has affected it because back east, when they couldn't get commodities out, that put a very big strain on the west to produce what the east typically had shipped out. So the weather played a part in it for us as well.
Wow. Couple minutes. What is the green sword?
The green sword is basically the Chinese government's efforts to prevent things from coming into their country that they don't want to deal with.
Okay.
So what happened, it started with the green fence, and there was people inside the country that would take anything. They would pay people a quarter per hour to sort through this and to pull commodities out. Because those people were driven by the money and the commodity, they would sneak that into the country. So we were getting inspections on every container that showed up at the port. And that was to the point where if it looked bad, the port officials would turn it away. That helped. It did clean it up a little bit. Well, now the green sword is because of the Pacific Rim trade and everything else. The Chinese government is saying nothing can come in. And it's their way of flexing their muscle a little bit to put some strain on the United States to not bring any commodity in to try to generate what they need locally.
Okay. Last minute or so, question for both of you, any regulations, changes coming out of Washington that are going to impact the solid waste industry?
No, I don't think so. Not that I'm aware of.
Not right
anything.
Now. Okay.
And for us, it would just be that Pacific Rim.
Okay. Yeah. So that's a trade related issue.
Correct.
Because this is, like you say, this is a commodity. This
is
raw material. This is tradable material that costs change on a daily basis, it sounds like.
We literally every day will shop some of the markets to see what happens, and it can move up and down just like other commodities, soy and rice and corn, different things. We shop it every day to see where it can go and to try to get the most return for the company.
Larry Gibbons, he's the Director of Business Development with Rocky Mountain Recycling, and of course, Reese DeMille with Republic Services. We thank you for taking the time and chat with us. website people can learn more
about? Yes, www.rockymountainrecycling.com. We've got some lists of acceptable materials. We've got some videos, some pictures, some recent awards that we've received, best in state 6 years in a row, and a couple different things there. So,
all right.
Fantastic.
All right. Again, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll have you back.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take a break for a couple of underwriters. When we come back, we'll speak with Dr. Diana Cox Foster about bees. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
This is Brenda with Republic Services, your local provider for recycling and garbage collection. Information about what is acceptable to put in your curbside recycling bin can be found at summitcountyrecycles.org. Please help Summit County be clean. Remember to recycle.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak. That's Nell Larson, right?
That's right. Right here across the board.
They're still here. And joining us on the phone is Dr. Diana Cox Foster. She's a research entomologist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Pacific West area. And she's giving a talk this Thursday at the Salt Lake City Public Library entitled Bees, Essential Keystones Supporting Our Food. Are they in danger? Here to help answer that question and others is Dr. Foster. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you for your invite. I greatly appreciate it.
Well, let's start with a little background about yourself. How did you get involved with bees and bee research?
Well, as a kid, I loved bees and other insects, so I became an entomologist. Over about 30 years ago, I joined Penn State University as a new assistant prof. And a year and a half ago, I transitioned from full professor to being a research leader up at Logan, Utah. And it was a nice event because I grew up in Colorado, actually went to school for a little bit in Utah, and got to come back west, but also work on a very important subject that's close and dear to my heart.
Well, tell us a little bit more about your current role and what it is that you're researching.
So I'm the research leader, sort of the boss, but also a scientist at up at the Pollinating Insect Research Unit in Logan. And our unit is unique. We're charged with looking at all the bees, not just honeybees, but all the bee species. And we're looking at how to implement and make their use more in agriculture, but also keep them healthy and also have a role in their conservation in our natural ecosystems. So our unit, we have 7 scientists now and about another 20, 30 people that are essential to our research that work with us. Some of them are students. They'll go on to hopefully their own careers. And we're also the home of the U.S. Pollinating Insect Collection. So we have a world-class collection of pollinators, not only here from the U.S., but also around the world.
Wow.
So there's about 20,000 species worldwide, we think, of bees. And here in the North America, we have 4,000. In Utah, we're very lucky, we have over 700, and we're discovering new species all the time, bees that we didn't ever know about.
Really? What's the latest discovery?
The latest one that we published on is a bee that actually makes its home in sandstone. So down in Escalante and other regions throughout the Southwest, this bee carves holes into the sandstone to make its nest, where it's going to grow up its brand new baby bees. And one of the other interesting facts that we've learned about this bee is that it can sort of do bed hedging. It can stay in diapause or estivation for at least 2 years and come out when the weather's better. So if you have a drought, it can weather that in part and wait in another year to come out when things might be a little bit better.
Well, how is a species like that discovered? Is it just serendipitous?
So several of our scientists go out regularly, and most recently they go into national parks or onto Forest Service land where we have collaborations or people interested in discovering what they have, and we do bee surveys. So we basically go in and try to look for everything possible, and you have to do it across the season because bees, not all bees are like honeybees that they're around all the time, but they may come up out only in short periods of time when their particular host plants are blooming and then disappear. But this can go on from extremely early in the spring till late in the fall when you see different bees.
So I've read that your site in Logan at USU is the only federally funded site that focuses on native bees versus honeybees.
That's correct.
Can you talk a little bit about why that is and how that differs?
One of the things why that differs is that honeybees are, you can think of them as the human insect livestock. So honeybees are actually brought to the United States. They're not a native bee here. And they were brought by the colonists way back when. We as humans have taken them everywhere that we've ever moved into or colonized. And so you can find honeybees worldwide right now, but they're native to Asia and parts of Europe and Africa, Apis mellifera. And so they've been an integral part of our agriculture from early on, from the beginning. You can actually find where they were used in agriculture. If you go back before Christ, you can find archaeological digs in Israel with the first known apiaries that were right there in the middle of town.
Hmm.
Huh. So honeybees have been in a focus because we've tended to depend upon them indirectly for pollination. We probably didn't greatly appreciate that early on, but also for the sugar production and the other byproducts, things like wax. For the native bees, they're a little bit harder to manage and keep going, but the lab up at Logan has a long history of figuring out how to do that with several species.
So what are... We've talked in the past about some of the threats that honeybees and all native bees face, whether it's chemical, biological, viral, et cetera. What are some of the trends in with respect to these threats? What are some greater than others?
So I've had the misfortune or fortune, depending on how you look at it, being involved in some of the initial studies when we knew pollinators were in danger back with colony collapse disorder. And we now know that there are what we call the four Ps that seem to all be involved and interact with one another. So ultimately, the pathogens, and that's part of my specialty, seem to be what bring down the colony. But normally, if the colony is healthy or if the native bee are healthy, they can withstand it. We also have parasites and parasitoids that can be part of it for honeybees' varroa. We also now know that poor nutrition is part of it, so P for the poor there. And that basically means that the number of flowers that are out there for the bees have greatly declined in number. So bees depend upon the flowers, of course, for nectar, but also most importantly for the pollen, which you can think of as their main nutritional source, their protein, their lipids, their vitamins, everything mom told you should eat. The last cause on there is pesticides, and there's been a lot of debate about this, and more research has been done worldwide, and it does show that you can either have a outright direct kill of the bees by a pesticide exposure. But more importantly, what we didn't appreciate before is that you can have these sublethal or chronic effects. And it may be on chemicals that are not even targeted for insects, things like fungicides. And most recently, I've been part of a research project where we've shown that some of the things that are added to the chemicals, the active ingredients, are of concern too. So it's a complicated situation. And a hard one to think about and tackle and to solve.
Well, in thinking about honeybees, both honeybees and native bees, I'm curious as to their role in agriculture. I think we often think it's the honeybees that do all the work. You know, the hives are brought into the, you know, almond fields or whatever, and they do all the work. But increasingly, it sounds like the native pollinators are also playing an important role. Mm. How much information is there about that?
We're still learning a great deal about that. The lab at Logan actually grew up out of Utah State University back when people realized it wasn't honeybees doing the pollination of alfalfa for seed production. So you have to have seeds to grow many plants, and that's where you also have to think about it in terms of food. Things like broccoli and lettuce, you would not normally think of them needing a pollinator, but you have to go back and think about where that plant came from, that it depended upon seed production. So even thing like onions, for instance. And the more that we look at it, where you have the native bees preserved and part of the agricultural environment, it's now shown that they can actually synergize with honeybees, that you'll get greater production of the actual crop itself, the fruit or the vegetable, or of the seeds. And our lab has been doing some work in California. One of my scientists, Teresa Pitzinger, has been working in almonds and showing that even in almonds where, for a long time now, honeybees are being brought in across the country to go there, that if you bring in the blue orchard bee, which is a native bee found in Utah and California, that you'll get greatly enhanced synergistic yields in almonds, even with full stocking rate of honeybees. So the grower can make extra money, and it suggests the results that suggest that even if you could figure out how to get more water or resources into the crop, that you could even get higher yields. And there's other parts of the country, back in Pennsylvania where I was a professor, there is a large apple growing area, and honeybees were typically brought in, but and when CCD occurred, there weren't the colonies available. And growers found that they were still getting great yields and pollination of their fruit. And it's been discovered now that the native bees are the ones doing it.
Hmm. Wow.
They're the natural woody areas are interlaced into the orchards so that these bees can make their homes in the woods and move over into the orchards. So native bees can play an essential role in food production as well. It's also in the environment. 90% of our plants depend upon pollination. So things that you would never associate with a bee, like a maple tree or oak tree, an ash tree, probably are getting some sort of pollination at some point, too. So they're in our natural environments. These native bees are doing most of the work.
Like I said, way more important than us. So we're speaking with Dr. Diana Cox Foster. She's a research entomologist at the USDA Agricultural Research Service, Pacific West Area, Pollinating Insects Research Unit in Logan, Utah.
That name is a mouthful,
Diana.
I did it. But, you know, getting back to the native species, you know, you talked about the four Ps and how they are impacting, say, domesticated bees, honeybees. I assume that these four Ps are also going to have an impact on native species too, like the blue orchard bee.
That's one of the reasons that I made the transition to come over and work in this lab, is that we focused a great deal on honeybees, but we still have a great deal to learn about the native bees. And the indications right now that, yes, indeed, these four Ps can be impacting all the native bees. But we don't really know the full extent of that and how these other bees will respond. We just had a meeting not too long ago that was hosted by EPA to ask about risk exposure to native bees by pesticides. Was it the same or greater than honeybees? And the conclusion that was made by researchers and regulatory entities from around the world and also agrochemical companies was indeed, yes, that there may be this greater risk of native bees having even more exposure to pesticides than some of the honeybees. But it still remains to be asked and to be demonstrated. So that's many of the questions that we're faced with here.
You also talked about poor nutrition, one of the Ps. I'm always curious as to the effects of having like a mono diet that these domesticated bees are confronted with, right? And Nell talked about almond trees and almond farms bringing in millions of bees, honeybees, to pollinate. But that's all they're faced with. You know, I love pizza, but if I had pizza every day, you know, there are probably going to be some physical impacts associated, some impacts associated with that. Is there harm in these mono diets that these domesticated bees face?
Well, it's much like you and I. If we just ate one food and that's the only food that we ever ate, we'd have nutritional deficiencies. And there is evidence for that in part in bees. It's been shown that if you have bees that have a polyfloral diet where they're able to get a lot of different pollens from different plants, mm-hmm. that they have a much stronger immunity and able to have markers in their blood, just like humans do, that they have a better physiology, greater health. And so that is part of the concern. So having areas with additional plants in it, even along a hedgerow, along a field, or along an orchard, can be an advantage. We have been, Teresa's been showing in almonds that if you have a wildflower strip planted alongside the almond orchard, that both the blue orchard bees and probably the honeybees are benefiting by that. And most importantly, what they've shown is that that little strip doesn't detract the bees from doing their job in pollinating the crop itself. So they're not just coming over and spending all their time in the wildflower area. But it's been shown now, too, that pollens are not the same, that they do have different nutritional makeup, in, for instance, in their fatty acid content. It'd be much like us thinking about eating omega-3 versus omega-6 fatty acids or eating healthy. These bees are somehow able to detect that and sense that and collect the nutrients that they normally need if it's available.
So I'm curious if listeners are interested in learning more about bees or how to identify bees, you know, some of these 700 some species that exist in Utah, what resources are out there to help people get into this?
So there's some great resources out there. One is a book that was written by a Utah State faculty member and his colleague. It's Joe Wilson, Olivia Messenger. It's called Native Bees, I Think, in Your Backyard. And it has some great pictures, and it's a great way for just the everyday person to learn a lot more about bees. If you also go on to the Utah State website or also Google our website, you can find brochures on there that have been developed by another one of my scientists, Jim Kane, about planting for native bees here in Utah and in other xeric-type areas in the Southwest, and also gardening for those bees. And there's we have a few publications about who the bees are and what they're doing. Mm. But I'd say that's the first step, is to begin reaching out and reading and looking at some of these things.
And am I correct, you're giving a talk this Thursday at the Salt Lake City Public Library?
That's right, Thursday evening. And be talking a little bit more about everything that we've discussed here,
right,
and showing hopefully some great images and videos and explaining things in a little bit more detail.
That's at Thursday the 23rd, 7 p.m., the Salt Lake City Public Library. One final question from me, at least. You're calling us from Washington, D.C. Have to ask. Is your research funding or funding for other programs, let's say, under threat with respect to the proposed budget?
So I'm here in Washington mainly from training, learning how government works, especially the Congress and laws.
Good luck.
and our funding right now, President Trump has put out a budget, and people need to just look at what areas he's suggesting where discretionary funds need to be removed. And a lot of the research arms of federal government are put into discretionary funds. So it's we'll see where it goes.
Right. It's in play, we'll say. Yeah.
Okay. So what is what's next in the world of bee research? What's, you know, trending right now, or what's the focus on as we look into the future?
There's many different avenues that people are trying to get into for honeybees, in part trying to figure out, are there other genetic strains out there that have greater resistance to diseases and can maybe withstand some of the pressures a little bit more? Just understanding the genetics of all the bees. For native bees, there's a lot of, we still don't know a whole lot about their populations. For honeybee colony, it's easy to figure out whether it's alive or dead, because you can go out there and lift the lid of the box and see inside. For native bees, they live in places where it's harder to look for them and find them. Like right now, the queen bumblebees are hibernating out in grassy areas that we don't really know how to say, go into a field and say, yes, there's going to be a bumblebee right over there. And so learning more about who they are, what their populations are, and how it's changing over time is really important. So that's where a lot of the focus is going to be.
And is there any opportunity, again, I keep asking this, but for folks to get involved? Citizen science is something we're hearing a lot about, and how, and you know, fireflies are obviously a little easier, but there are a lot of opportunities in that area to help, you know, track or identify. Does the same thing exist with native bees?
So for bee species, it's a little bit harder because you have so many different kinds, especially in Utah. But the easiest way for people to maybe keep track of things is to take pictures. And to there's actually researchers that go patrolling the web and seeing what pictures of bees are out there, and having as much information on there, like what day it was caught, what time, a rough location. It doesn't have to be exact GPS location, are useful information to allow research just get an idea, is this species showing up in other places, for instance. There's some bumblebee species found in California, one in particular that hasn't been seen in almost 10 years now, that we are afraid that it did go extinct. So just having pictures of the bees makes a great help. But they have to be high-quality pictures, which makes the other challenge to it.
Right. Okay.
But the main thing that people can do is, you know, just trying to plant for the bees. Right. And think before you put down a pesticide, do you really need this, or are there other ways that you can control the pests that you're targeting?
Right. That's pesticide, that's herbicide, that's fungicide, that's any rodenticide, any of those chemical compounds are all a threat, particularly to ground-based
right.
bees. And now I thought of another question. We love our Kentucky bluegrass out here. Is grasses like that beneficial to bees or honeybees or ground-based bees at all, or should
so
I?
So that's a great question.
Yeah.
So when if you think about lawn care, people envision this beautiful green lawn that's perfectly green and all the same color, and that when a bee looks at that, that's basically like looking at a desert.
Okay.
And the picture that I showed people back when I've given lectures and mentioned that before is a picture of the petrified forest, and people back east just can't comprehend, you know, it's just all sand and rock with very few plants there. But that's basically what the bees are seeing. There's nothing there for them. There's no food. There's nothing there to make their nests. And unfortunately for a lot of people who want that kind of lawn, they're buying lawn products. And some of those include in them insecticides and fungicides as well, just to try help protect it. So it's not really an environment that helps the bees. Myself, I tend to go for the polycultural lawn that has clover in it, and I do like yellow, so I like dandelions. I live
okay.
out in the country where I don't have to worry about my neighbors being upset with me. But
right. But that's
so having, you know, trying to create a lawn that has a lot of diversity in it is good too.
Okay. There you go. Yet another reason of the many that are already out there to tear up your lawn and replace it with native grasses, clover, plants, other pollinator friendly species. So, hey, again, we have to run, but again, your talk is this Thursday, down at the Salt Lake City Public Library. It's entitled Bees, Essential Keystones Supporting Our Food. Are They in Danger? That's at 7 p.m. Dr. Diana Cox Foster. Again, thank you so much for talking. And again, it's 4,000 bees in North America and counting.
That's right.
That's right. Well, there could be, there's always another one out there to discover. Again, yeah. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Well, thank you.
All right. Let's take a quick break for a couple underwriters. When we come back, we got a news item or two to squeeze in.
That's
How about
right.
that?
And it's time to wrap up.
All right. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchard from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Hey, we got a couple minutes. Maybe squeeze in a calendar event or reminder. One reminder, it's spring, and that means you can turn your rooftop heat tape off, folks.
That's right.
Okay? The
right icicle, at the breaker.
Icicle season is over. Ice dam season is done. So if you, just as a reminder, I know a lot of people turn them on in November, and then they kind of remember somewhere around May that their heat tape is on. Go out and check it. If it's on, you can probably turn it off. Feel comfortable that you can turn it. You know what? If it snows, which it's supposed to, you can turn it back on. But otherwise, hey, the rule of thumb, right? You change your batteries at daylight savings in your
You should
turn your heat tape off around daylight savings too. All right. And Nell, did you have a reminder?
Well, there are a couple of events coming up that we're hosting at Swanner that are like really related to this bee stuff we were just talking about. We have local food producers, farmers and ranchers at our event called Meet the Producers. That's in conjunction with Recycle Utah and Eats. And that is Thursday, March 30th from 5 to 7 p.m.
Okay.
And then we have a whole exhibit on insects opening on April 1st, on Saturday, April 1st, with a section on bees. So if April you want to learn more,
we'll talk about it again before then.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Reese DeMille, again, thanks for coming on the show.
That's right. And he wanted us to emphasize that summitcounty.org has all the information you need to know about what you can and cannot put in your recycling bin, in your single stream bin. Summitcounty.org. It's all there.
Once again.
Please reference it if you have a question.
Please. for the sake of Larry at the Rocky Mountain Recycling
That's
and his
right.
Murph.
That's right.
All right. Let's thank our underwriters and supporters who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail's Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
and Park City Mountain.
That's right. You can also email us your thoughts, your comments, your ideas for future shows. We love to hear from you and love to get your ideas at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM in Park City. We've got your Wasatch back. NPR News is next.